Support for the following program comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Additional funding comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas.
This is Soundings, a program of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Race and Identity, this week on Soundings. For Black History Month, join me now for conversations featuring scholars from Emory and George Mason Universities. They'll reflect on how African-American writers have given expression to the interplay between their ethnic and individual identities. Hortense Spillers is a professor of English and Women's Studies at Emory University. In a recent piece about the influences of history in modern-day lives, she examines what she calls the condition of the mother. Although her title is whimsical, it's called Mama's Baby, Papa's Maybe, Spillers explores how slavery forced black people into counterproductive social structures. Hortense Spillers.
Well, I think that's what I'm saying, even though I would probably not want to substitute, and I know you didn't say that, but I probably wouldn't want to substitute a matriarchy for a patriarchy.
Okay.
Because I don't think it is a matriarchal culture at all. But I think that the African-American woman, or the African woman in that circumstance, did bear a very special relationship to her community by law.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that writes a different kind of culture script or a different kind of text.
Take me back in time. Take me back to some of these slave narratives that you have cited in your work, Hortense, mm-hmm. and talk to me about how they are important in shaping, if not a matriarchy, at least a maternal identity in our understanding today of African-American men and women and children.
Yeah. You know, what's interesting about that question is that most of the slave narratives that we know were actually not penned by women, right? I mean, I won't say important, but I would say the classical ones, say,
mm-hmm.
are written by male figures like Frederick Douglass.
So, pardon the expression, we've already colored the picture, and we've colored it incorrectly. Is that right?
In part, yeah, I think so.
All right, so how do we recover this sense of identity then, much less its influence on what African-American people are today, if we don't have a primary document to work with? Or am I getting off the point here?
Well, I think there are primary documents. I think we have to learn how to read them. I think we have to discover where they are.
Uh-huh.
For instance, the 19th century women writers series, the Schomburg collection,
mm-hmm.
of texts that Skip Gates recently edited,
right,
is a 30-plus volume set of books.
So there's a lot there to study.
So there, yeah.
Fair
that's
enough.
Right. I think there's more there to study than we thought or imagined
uh-huh.
at one time.
All right, well, what do we find there? And why is that important, again, to our understanding of African-American culture in the 1990s?
Well, I think what we find there is a suppressed story or suppressed stories
mm-hmm.
or lost stories. For instance, I'm not sure if Ida B. Wells' story is in that Schomburg volume, but there are women ministers, for instance,
mm-hmm.
in that collection. And so what you find out is that women participate in the culture in ways that we hadn't anticipated before, and in visible ways that actually become lost over time. So
do you think that as this material comes to light, Hortense, that we are drastically going to reshape our canonical notions of what constitutes American experience and American literature? Is this going to be a reshaping or an addition to that previous understanding?
Well, I think in some ways it will be both. I don't think you can get an addition without changing the configuration.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I mean, I think that at least you're going to get a lean-to,
right,
as we used to call it, right? I mean, the house is going to have another room on it.
Right.
So I think by adding that you do, in fact, shift the configuration or shift the form a bit. It seems to me that you really can't, you really cannot retrieve certain texts or certain experiences in the culture and not change it.
Now, when you recover these texts and these experiences, the word you just used, Hortense Spillers, let me be a little bit politely impertinent here. I mean, to what end does all of this occur? You've got, you know, you English professors doing your work in the ivory tower, as it were. The critics of this kind of activity say, wait a minute, what's really going on here is a political agenda to empower a certain segment of our society. Now, I'm not telling you that that's necessarily bad. The critics say that it is. I want you to comment on that kind of charge and tell me about its interplay with aesthetic, literary concerns.
Yeah, well, first of all, I think there is probably not ever a disconnection or apolitical or unpolitical motive in the making of canons.
Uh-huh. Teaching is a political act.
Sure, yeah. Sure. Uh-huh. I think that it is. How it relates to the aesthetic, I think, is complicated. I think that's another book or another topic within itself. But I guess I'm saying that there is a power motivation or mm-hmm. a political dimension to what we think is beautiful or important or valuable. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that we don't arrive at those understandings just kind of neutrally, and because those things are inherently valuable and beautiful and good. I mean, it seems to me that there is some motivation or deliberation involved in the ways in which we learn things. Mm-hmm. Right? I know that it's important.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's no question in my mind that what goes on in our classrooms affect what senators think and presidents think and so on.
Well, let's talk about your classrooms. How do you take this stuff into the classroom? To be uncharitable, the critics would say that here is a black feminist critic who takes this stuff into the classroom, politicizes education, brainwashes students. Now, those are strong words and strong charges. Yeah. How do you react to them when they're leveled at you?
Well, I don't think anybody has ever leveled those charges at me. I think I would probably laugh because I think those charges are excessive.
Uh-huh.
I think they're beside the point. I think that they shield another agenda, that they're really about something else,
right?
That one way to talk about this something else is to put it in the form of a critique that I think doesn't take us very far. But what I would like to do with this material, and this is what the longer project is doing, is considering what happens to gender and gender relations under specific historical conditions. Because it seems to me that, both gender and race as instruments of analysis tend to be ahistorical or a little bit abstract.
Mm-hmm. And you want to make them historical and concrete.
Exactly.
Uh-huh. Are you successful at this in the classroom? Let me ask you to, you know, sort of pat yourself on the back here. How do your undergraduate students at Emory take to pieces like Mama's
like
Baby, Papa's Maybe, or African American slave narratives? What goes on there?
Okay. Well, I haven't taught this particular piece in an undergraduate classroom. Slave narratives at the undergraduate and graduate level work very well.
Uh-huh.
I mean, the students are very responsive to that material. I think they would be responsive to this. I mean, if I find a way to make the translation, because actually what I'm attempting to do is to suggest that the question of gender, the question of women's community, that those questions change as the historical situation changes.
Mm-hmm.
And that there is a comparative formula that can be applied between the lives of African-American women in the United States and Anglo-American women in the United States, and that you can compare them along
productively.
Yeah, productively. Uh-huh. And along historical lines.
Uh-huh.
And so this is sort of the first take in an attempt to historicize our notions of gender, or to provide an example of how we can historicize and concretize notions of gender.
Hortense, we've got just a couple of moments left. Let me ask you to give me a brief answer to a real tough question. You optimistic from your standpoint as a scholar of African-American literature? You optimistic about race relations in this country Are we kidding ourselves when we say that, well, we're making progress, and, you know, we use large words like that? Yeah. Do I have to be black to understand what you stand for, what you think? I mean, how you are as a citizen, and not to mention, you know, your role in the academy. Do you have to be white to understand the way I work and think?
No, I don't. I don't think we do. And I am hopeful. I hope not foolishly so, but my understanding of what we do in the making of culture. And in the being made by culture is to come to an understanding of one another's social and historical and political realities. I think one way that that you can get that is to get it in books and through study. And so that's why the classroom for me is an important tool of change and exchange. That we learn many things in classrooms, right? I mean, one falls in love with cultures that are very different cultures and other languages through a classroom.
Yeah, and those kids are always learning, no matter what's going on in the classroom.
Absolutely, and I think as long as we don't give up our own sense of wonder, if you will. I mean, if we allow the child in us to speak who has a certain kind of curiosity and wonder about the world, I mean, it seems to me that that's hopeful. And that's where it happens for us as black and white people in a culture that we share.
Mm-hmm. Hortense Spillers, I want to thank you for this conversation on Soundings for Black History Month. You're working on a project called In the Flesh, A Situation for Feminist Inquiry. Good luck with your work here at the Humanities Center and at Emory.
Thank you, Wayne.
This is Soundings, a program of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. For Black History Month, a conversation now about the American philosopher and social critic Alan Locke. I'll talk with Alan Locke's biographer, Jeffrey Stewart, of George Mason University. Alan Locke was the first black African-American to win a Rhodes Scholarship and the first to earn a doctorate in philosophy from Harvard University. According to Jeffrey Stewart, Locke came to be known not for economic or political activism, but as a cultural critic who consciously developed an image of himself as a public philosopher. Jeffrey Stewart.
Well, I think that in any kind of biography, you want to have a tension between the life and the times. And certainly Locke, being born in 1885, dying in 1954, his life covers that period of time in which life was generally segregated for black Americans in the United States. And yet with 54, you have a kind of, crisis and a breakdown of that segregation and the beginning of integration. So much of his life was organized around trying to promote integration, and he felt that through art and literature, through appreciation of the creativity of black Americans, some of the division between the races could be broken down.
Tell me, Jeffrey Stewart, how you work the interplay between the life of this man, Alan Locke, and the work and what he represents as a philosopher. Mm-hmm. Is it important that, for example, that I know a lot about his personal life, about where he was born, how he grew up, in order to have an overview of his philosophical positions?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what I've been operating under. I mean, I first started work on it when I was a graduate student at Yale in 1971, and really at that point did mainly a study of his ideas. But now as I've gotten further into the papers, which are located at Howard University, I began to contextualize his ideas and see how his grappling with these come out of problems that he deals with in his everyday life. Mm-hmm. For example, his philosophy of cultural pluralism or value pluralism, which he called the right to be different, to be tolerated because of your difference in the United States.
Is this what we call multiculturalism today?
Yes, I would say so.
With as strong a political message attached to it?
Well, You know, that's interesting. I would say that it has to be political in a certain way. It was certainly political in the 1920s when you had 100% Americanism.
Yeah, only it was 99 to 1 against.
Right, right. So I think that now it's much more accepted that one should be able to have their own cultural identity as well as being a 100% American in political and social terms. But I've found, for example, that one of the reasons he was interested in this is because I think he felt that he was ostracized, that he felt that he was different. Locke was a gay black man in the early 20th century and felt, you know, that he was forced to conform not only on a racial level, but also to the sort of heterosexualism that existed.
How are you organizing this study, Jeffrey Stewart? Do you begin on the day of this man's birth and move to the day of his death? What do you, how do you move these parts around?
I'm really trying to, I have an opening chapter which focuses on the death of his mother. His mother was a very powerful force in his life and represented what I call the sort of black Victorian tradition of middle class respectability, manners, good taste, and those sorts of things.
Imitating the white culture.
Right. But also having that imitation having a very early, you know, origin in the 19th century. And so by the early 20th century, it had its own values, its own ways of looking at the world that were really, what I'm arguing, black Victorian. And her death essentially releases him, I'm arguing, to a certain extent from that tradition.
And how old was he when she died?
She was about, let's see, she died in 1922. So he was 37.
Uh-huh.
And so he then goes on to become a major figure in the Harlem Renaissance. So I kind of use that as a kind of my opening scene, her death and his sort of rebirth.
Mm-hmm.
And then I go back in the next chapter and talk about his upbringing in Philadelphia and sort of detail this Victorian culture that existed among the middle and upper class blacks in Philadelphia.
Now, you have just mentioned Jeffrey Stewart, the Harlem Renaissance. Why is Alan Locke important in that time period? Give me a time frame to begin with.
With the Harlem Renaissance?
Yeah, we talk about it, and we mean from when to when.
Well, I guess most people sort of would look at it, say, maybe 1920 to 1929, I guess, is the shortest.
Mm-hmm.
I think you could also say that it's sort of 1918 to 1945. It's a perhaps a longer period of time.
And it represents much more than the Apollo Theater.
Right, yes, it does. Well, it really represents the sort of, and Locke, I would say, is connected because he came up with this notion of it being a renaissance, or at least promoted the notion that it was a renaissance, that it was an outpouring of talent, a kind of revival of creativity for black Americans, where people began to write poetry, short stories, novels about the black experience, rather than just doing race relations and race contact things, really doing sort of portraits of the black community.
Well, now, you mentioned earlier, Jeffrey, that he was gay. That remains a difficult situation to be in. Here we are in the enlightened 1990s. My goodness, what about in the early part of this century? Did he hide his homosexuality? What did he do with it?
Well, I think that he was probably the most well-known sort of public black person that was known to be gay. I mean, he wasn't publicly identified as gay, but I mean, I think most people who are in the black community surrounding, you know, Howard and Washington and that whole area knew that he was gay. And so in that sense, he was something of a role model for other young black men. I mean, I've seen letters where people are sort of calling for advice, and he wasn't a person who essentially had a internal problem with the fact he was gay. He wasn't sort of deciding, am I bisexual or whatever. He was pretty comfortable with it. At the same time, I think he was very frightened that he could be exposed, that there'd be scandals, that he could be blackmailed. And at this time, if you were exposed as being gay and teaching at a school like Howard University or something like that, you could easily lose your job and perhaps even be jailed. So I think it did have a tendency to make him much more careful and discreet and somewhat distant with people. On the other hand, there are many people who say that he was able to keep these things separate. He was able to nurture talent and to be very supportive of people, that he was a much more accessible man than, say, someone like W.B. Du Bois, and that he cared about developing, you know, Afro-American creativity in a way that you know, a lot of other people wouldn't have been concerned. So mm-hmm. I found it to be, in many ways, helpful to him. It makes him a risk taker. It makes him somewhat more critical of his own culture because he's an outsider to it.
Jeffrey Stewart, let's talk for a few minutes about black studies in the United States. Here, mm-hmm. again, you're writing this biography of Alan Locke. Give me a sense of what Locke went through mm-hmm. with respect to black studies and how far or not far have
right.
we come.
Right. Well, when he was at first a young professor at Howard University in 1912, he was interested in starting a department of Africana studies. And when mm-hmm. they acquired the Moreland Foundation in 1914, he proposed that they would develop a department of study and research around that. And he wanted them to do race relations studies. And at that time, Howard didn't really want to be known primarily as a Negro institution. And so there was a certain amount of poo-pooing of this. And actually, he wasn't able to get it started. There was a sense, in a way, I guess, that black studies was not really the thing that blacks ought to be oriented to. They should be trying to acquire knowledge mm-hmm. in the more broader issues.
And now you don't have a respectable university without an African-American studies program.
Right. But you also still, I think, have the criticism of Afrocentrism
right,
or African American studies programs have often been criticized as being in some way a barrier to the fuller integration and assimilation of blacks within the larger culture. And I think he would have probably objected to that. We still seem to be fighting that kind of battle, that if someone does something purely a black novel, like, for example, Toni Morrison's Beloved, right. you know, that doesn't always seem to be an American novel to the larger audience. So that kind of problem of seeing black culture as representative of America is still a problem for us.
What do you say to the following kind of question, Jeffrey Stewart? If we want to live in a colorblind society, why should we valorize, I think is one of the ways to put it, why mm-hmm. should we valorize black studies? Mm-hmm. Why don't we just have American culture and do our best with these sort of sub-facets? Mm-hmm. What about that?
Well, I think that's presumes, I guess, the answer to the question. It says, do we want to live in a colorblind society? I mean, we again, if we go back to Locke's theory, you know, race is a historical phenomenon. Uh-huh. So we're starting now with a society that is very color conscious, and we have to start there. And people experience conflict around color and race. And so when we have things like black studies programs, it's often a way in which those who feel that they need a kind of spiritual home within a often very hostile and non-colorblind society can find some resources to be successful.
You're not talking about race again. You're talking about community, just a sense of
right.
belonging.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And race often is a sort of screen or mirror for a lot of other issues that are bothering us as Americans, but we can sort of project them more easily if we put them in the form of race.
All right. Let me get personal with you for a moment, Jeffrey Stewart. Do you think that because you're black, you write a better book about Alan Locke?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know if that's true. I mean, I think what it really comes down to is that there aren't other books out there, and it's partly because I'm black that I'm writing it. I mean, I'm interested in some of the issues that are involved in a way. I don't think it's a question of a better book. I probably can empathize with some aspects of his life because I see valences of them in my own life or in the lives of other black academics, but I don't think that the question of a better or you know, mediocre book comes purely because of race. There are some fantastic books that have been done on blacks. I think that Harlan's biography of Booker T. Washington is a very good book.
Mm-hmm.
It used to be the counter theory, really, which we've sort of forgotten, which is that only good books about blacks could be written by non-blacks because they wouldn't be so personally involved.
Do you have a model biography in mind, Jeffrey Stewart, as you write this book about Alan Locke? I mean, is there a, you know, one person, one life written by one scholar that you look at and say, well, I hope I can measure up to that, or, you know, you use that as a standard?
Right. I don't know. I've been using a few. It seems like that you know, at various times, I rely more on one. I really like Richard Ellman's biography of Oscar Wilde, and so that's been kind of inspiring me recently, but particularly because of his work on when Wilde was at Oxford, and Wilde, who was Irish, had a lot of tension sort of with the sort of English establishment, and so that kind of helps me. And then just Ellman is really just such a master biographer that it's good to have him in the back of your mind, even if you don't reach that level.
Here's a footnote question to our conversation, Jeffrey Stewart. You've spent a lot of time with this man, Alan Locke. You think about him. You go through all the documents. Is there a particular kind of question or curiosity that recurs, that comes back to you? If you could actually talk to Alan Locke, what would you ask him?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that the real question is, how do you sustain yourself? How do you sustain yourself working in a segregated world without the kind of rewards that come to other scholars who have a Rhodes Scholarship and a Harvard PhD and are forced to more or less work within a more narrow constraints? How do you sustain that? How do you find the internal source of motivation to keep going? Because I need that myself as I keep going on this project. But I think that's really the thing that keeps me in awe of people like Locke and Du Bois, is how they were found the sources of motivation, given that they really didn't have the external rewards that people have today.
Well, Jeffrey Stewart, I wish you well with your biography, and I appreciate your taking time to talk to our audience on Soundings.
Okay, thanks a lot.
This is Soundings, a program of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. You've been listening to the concluding segment in a series of conversations for Black History Month 1992. The speakers on this program were Hortense Spillers of Emory University and Jeffrey Stewart of George Mason University. If you'd like a cassette copy of their discussions, send $5 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 595. That's program number 595, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, the zip code 27709. Send $2 for a complete listing of Soundings discussions available on cassettes, and when you write, please mention the call letters of this radio station. The National Humanities Center welcomes your comments. Next week, Historical Companions. I'll talk with Laurel Thatcher Ulrich of the University of New Hampshire and with John Garrity of Columbia University. Laurel Thatcher Ulrich won the Pulitzer Prize for History last year for her account of midwifery, medicine, and society in early America. John Garrity will talk about his new book, The Reader's Companion to American History. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Please join me again next week at this time on this radio station. Until then, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center.
Partial support for this program comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Race and Identity, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me for conversations with Hortense Spillers of Emory University and Jeffrey Stewart of George Mason University. Spillers discusses Black women and North American expressive culture. Stewart discusses his biography of the African-American philosopher Alan Locke. The Ethnic and the Individual Identities of Black Writers and Artists. Some answers and insights from the National Humanities Center this week on Soundings.